You're listening to Behind the Headlines, a weekly news talk show hosted by the Express News Group, publishers of the Southampton Press, the East Hampton Press, the Sag Harbor Express, 27East.com, and Express Magazine, and featuring distinguished journalists from the East End to discuss what's news on the North and South Forks of Long Island. I'm Bill Sutton. I'm the managing editor of the Express News Group. I'm joined today by my co-host, Annette Hinkle, who is the arts and living editor for the Express News Group. Good morning, Annette.
Good morning, Bill.
Our panelists this week are our regular, Denise Civiletti, editor of Riverhead Local. Good morning, Denise.
Good morning.
Beth Young, editor and publisher of the East End Beacon. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning.
And Christopher Gangemi, staff writer for the East Hampton Star. Good morning, Chris.
There. Good morning.
So let's start with the First District congressional race. There's been some developments with that. It looks like the primary is starting to heat up a little bit. We had Nancy Goroff, who has announced earlier this year in January that that she's going to run again. She ran against former Congressman Lee Zeldin in 2020 and lost. And then John Avalon, the journalist and former political analyst at CNN, announced recently that he was going to run, and he had he kicked off his campaign at a rally in Sag Harbor and Marine Park last weekend. And the two of them had a debate in East Hampton, Beth?
They had a debate in Jamesport. I believe there might have also been one in East Hampton. Chris, do you know?
I did not attend.
Okay. Yeah, I went to the one in Jamesport.
I think they had one at LTV, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah. But they've been making the rounds for sure, trying to show voters the difference between their positions. I think there's not a lot of air between the two of them on the issues, but their campaign styles couldn't be more different. Nancy Goroff was always a very introspective candidate. The last time she ran, she talked a lot about policy and things that she would change from a policy perspective in terms of Medicare and the tax code. Very, very specific policy proposals that if you weren't really into this stuff, you might not follow for very long.
Kind of wonky stuff that we look at, but
yeah, we love it. But John Avalon, he started as I think one of his first jobs was as a speechwriter for Rudy Giuliani, and he wrote the eulogies for the firefighters who died on 9/11. And he worked for Bill Clinton's campaign before that, so he's always been very interested in the center. But he's also, an orator. He's got his lines all polished, like he's been speaking them for years. Some of them are,
Well, I mean, he was a
paid
personality, right? I mean, that maybe comes a little easier for him.
Absolutely. Yeah. So he was drawing a lot of applause for, the things he said at the debate, but a lot of it was, unions built the middle class and the middle class built America. The standard things here on campaign trail.
Rah-rah stuff, huh?
Yeah, and he got the crowd going, and Nancy's already tried and lost, but she wasn't running against Nicolodo last time. I think she took home 44% of the vote against Lee Zeldin in 2020. And that was an anomaly of an election year in and of itself. But, this district is kind of evenly split between Republicans, Democrats, and independents. So the Cook Political Report says it's likely Republican at this point, but the race could be activated.
Mm-hmm. So who ran against LaLota in 2022? I can't remember.
It was Bridget.
That was Bridget.
Was it Bridget?
Bridget Fleming.
Bridget. Okay.
Yeah.
And I don't. I'm trying to remember the numbers there. I don't think it was super close. But
yeah.
So Avalon had a kickoff event in Sag Harbor, Chris, right? He had a lot of local Democratic support at the rally. A lot of local dignitaries.
I mean, everybody was there, and if you're a Democrat or an independent, or even if you're just a never Trumper, I think you're excited by his candidacy because, I understand what Beth you're saying. He has this polished way, but if he can attract voters, which I think that might attract voters. You know, his personality is very engaging. And he says, I think it's an important message right now in this divided situation we've got going on. And I think the challenge is going to be communication. And I'm actually fascinated by it. How are you going to run a centrist type of campaign? So I think he's an interesting candidate, and I'm looking forward. It does seem like he's kind of cleared the decks, and you know, Nancy Goroff does have a lot of money, but you know, to me, I don't know how long she's going to hang around. Is there a lot of excitement about her candidacy? I don't feel like there is. I don't think a lot of people are like, yeah, Nancy Goroff. So
yeah, and all the other candidates dropped out when he announced.
Yeah. So I don't know how long she stays in.
She's based more Western, right? So she's Stony Brook. So, I mean, there may be a little more excitement up there that we're not hearing
right
here. And certainly she, you know, she knows the issues, and she's, you know, she's, again, she's run for the seat before, but I hear what you're saying. I think that Avalon's just got a lot of flash. I mean, again, he's used to the public speaking. He's, you know, he's used to, you know,
he's a media personality.
Exactly. I
mean, and that's what plays, you know, especially today. And, you know, I'm sorry, like, policy wonks always had a hard time getting elected and staying elected, and even more so in the current climate, don't you think? I mean,
oh, absolutely.
You know, so I don't know. I mean, I don't really have an opinion about either of them, but I just don't. I mean, on the face of it, from what I see and hear, I think he stands a better chance of unseating this freshman incumbent from Amityville.
Yeah.
I just wonder if policy matters right now in the electorate.
I really don't. I mean, the top of the ticket on the Republican side is someone who doesn't seem to have much consideration for policy, right? I mean, I don't know.
Unless you're talking about crime or the border.
And what are the policies really? I mean, those are things that get, you know, that he throws out there, like, right. You know, but what are the policies? Like, you know, it's easy to say things like, and, you know, sling slogans and stuff, but and lead chants, but you know, that's not policy. I mean, you know, so unfortunately, that's what we've come to now. And, it's not a happy place, I don't think.
Yeah. I think, you know, Lalota is you know, painting both Avalon and, you know, as elitist. I mean, if you look at the stuff that he's sending out now, and you know, which is I think, you know, typical, you know, GOP versus Democrat stuff. Now Democrats are elitists, and Republicans are we're the blue collar guys that are, you know, going to protect I think it's not about policy. It becomes about personality and, you know, and all that, and I think that's a shame.
Naval Academy is a pretty good place to graduate from too. I mean, right. You know, so I think it's kind of hard to, you know, paint somebody as an elitist. I mean, you can paint them as a Manhattanite, but right. You know, if you want to do that, but I don't know.
Yeah. And like I said, I mean, you know, Avalon at least has a house in Sac Harbor.
Right.
You know, he lives
in the district.
Right.
Well, I mean, Lalota doesn't live that far outside the district. And, it's, you know, this really is something that just keeps coming down to up the island versus out east, and what, you know, where the electorate is motivated. One thing that I think might be an outcome of this is the Nick LaLota's Make Plum Island a National Monument bill, probably because Republicans know he's in a contested election here. It's gotten farther in the House than any bill to preserve Plum Island so far, so that we could see some action on that this year, just so he has a feather in his cap going into the election, which would play out east. So we'll see.
That's
what
a good point.
Yeah.
How far outside the district is Amityville? I'm not certain. I mean, he had said
not
he was
that far. There might be even parts of Amityville. I don't know that are very close. Yeah, I mean, farming.
Let's look at.
Yeah,
I'm not as upset about it as other people, but he did say he was going to move into the district. Right. But we all know how difficult it is to buy a house on Long Island, and you have kids in the school districts and all that stuff. But it feels like a little bit of a broken promise that he hasn't that he hasn't really addressed in the last, 2 years.
I mean, frankly, I don't care about the district thing as much as I care about the Trump stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that's for me. And I feel like a lot of voters are just going to, it's going to be a litmus test on Trump.
Well, I mean, that's the scary part about the whole Groundhog Day election that we're having, this year, right? Is 4 years ago, I mean, you had even strong Republicans who were bashing Trump and not support and all that. And it seems like everybody's turned around and now that he's, he muscled through and is the presumptive nominee, you've got everybody, backing him again publicly. And, and I think he's leading in some polls and stuff too. And it's just, it's just weird. It's just so weird that we're back to, Trump Biden again.
Yeah. I mean, but I think that I don't want to get into the same problem that we had in 2016 with the polls, but my father-in-law is a lifelong Republican. He lives in Setauket. And I think that John Avalon has the ability to communicate to voters like that. I mean, he can't stand Donald Trump. I mean, he actually is crazy enough to get into discussions with people in diners up Island about Donald Trump. And I'm like, please, Dom, like, don't do it. Just, it's not worth it. And, but he loves John Avalon. You know, he's read his books. He's into him, and he's a lifelong Republican. So I think that's what makes this candidacy and this race interesting. I do think that John Avalon knows how to speak to people who might be on the fence, possibly more than Nancy Garoff, for the reasons that Beth spoke about. I don't know if wonkiness is going to win this election. I think there's something else that's going to have to draw people in.
Right.
And you're right. It is an up island thing, East End. We don't have the numbers out here. So he's going to have to figure that part out. And communication, I just think it's fascinating here in this election. I can't wait. I'm kind of a nerd about it.
And let's not forget that it's Groundhog Day again with George Santos, who has said he's going to run for our seat as well.
And
another
now,
one.
But now he's our groundhog.
Yeah, he's such quite the groundhog.
Yeah.
Well, they have till April 4th to get their nominating petitions in. And
so we'll have to see if that
happens. How many real signatures he can come up with.
Oh, they'll be forged. Don't worry.
He started Groundhog's Day, right? That was his resume.
I know that.
let's turn our attention a little bit to Sag Harbor. We had a story on 27 East and the Express this week that Canio's Bookstore, or Canio's Books, which is long been as reporter Steve Coates referred to it, a cornerstone of the cultural community in Sag Harbor, is looking for a new home. They've been told by their landlord that she wants to renovate the building and that they're going to need to vacate. And we all know how difficult it is to find commercial space in Sag Harbor. The owners, Catherine Zoka and Marianne Calendrill, are trying to be optimistic and positive in the article anyway, and saying that they're looking at it as a new chapter, but haven't been able to secure anything yet. I mean, it really is a cultural hub for the village, right, Annette?
Yeah, I mean, I know we've read the Moby Dick marathon readings there, you and I, Bill, and Joe, yeah, and a few other people from the paper. I've done talks on my book about the cinema, and I'm definitely way more famous people than me have been in that bookstore, you know? But again, it's like, I think that a lot of us saw this coming a long time ago. Like, we knew that the landlord, Martha Siegler, you know, wanted to do some renovations, and I feel like, you know, she's given them a very fair rent. And, you know, it's hard to throw out an institution, you know, but I have a feeling that there were inklings of this coming for a long time. I don't think this is out of the blue. You know, I think that, that there was talk that she was going to at some point, have to get in there, and it's a real creaky old space. It's very cool. It's, you know, cluttered, it's creaky floors. And I mean, I'm sure that I'm sure that she's right about there needing to be some renovations there.
It's everything a bookstore is supposed to be, right? I mean, you walk in and it's just stacks and stacks, and it's that smell of old paper and old books. And
it's been there since 1980, when Canio Pavoni, the guy who started it, used to sell books on the street in Manhattan. And one day he was out in Riverhead for jury duty, reading Joe Pintaro's novel Cold Hands, which is set in Sag Harbor. And having never been there, he was released early from jury duty and decided to drive out to Sag Harbor to see what it was all about. And he happened to drive by the Canio's building, which was not owned by the current landlord at that point. And there was like a for rent sign in the window. So he just went in, and it was, you know, probably $200 a month or something back then. So he moved in like pretty quickly. So it's kind of a funny story that started with a novel and jury duty, which is always an interesting twist. So.
Yeah, it's a heartbreaking, you know, to think that it could be gone. When I first moved here in 2001, and I was looking to rent the place across the street from Canio's, and that was the first place I went into in Sag Harbor. And I walked in, and I was immediately like, okay, this is where I'm going to live. This is the place. Because of what you described, Bill, like that old bookstore, it's like the place you want. I should say it's the place a certain type of person wants to be. Right. And I just hope that, you know, Catherine and Marianne have done so much for the community, you know, with the Steinbeck House and so many other things that they've been involved in. I hope that there's some way of preserving them. And I don't know, I haven't figured it out yet myself on how that's going to work. It's,
and of course, the irony is they just opened up a giant Barnes and Nobles at Bridgehampton Commons.
Right.
You know, talk about, like, you know, reversal of where we had been going. So Barnes and Noble must think there's still a literary group out here that wants to buy books in person. So,
well, they opened up in Riverhead too.
They did. Year. That's right.
Yeah. And they're, from what I understand, they're doing well. And, you know, it's a company that's actually a bookseller that's actually growing.
Yeah.
Which, you know, that's different from what we had been seeing. And, you know,
I think it's become kind of a niche market.
Yeah.
To, you know, for actual books like LPs and albums now, right? And vinyl albums.
There too,
you know, that's people who want that experience. But I mean, as Chris pointed out with Canio's, I mean, it's more than just a bookstore. It's a bookstore, but it's more than that. And they did, you know, they did start their nonprofit, the Canio's Cultural Cafe, and they just do a lot of they do a lot of good in the community, but they also bring people into the store for different events. And, you know, as Annette, you know, mentioned the Moby Dick readings and all that. And so we, you know, we wish them well. Hopefully they, you know, don't hesitate and find something suitable. Maybe, you know, maybe one of the developers in the village will come forward with,
maybe Adam Potter.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is they do have that nonprofit arm, which may allow them to go into places that they wouldn't be able to go to if they were only a for-profit entity. Like I'm thinking, you know, I don't know, like an annex of a church or something like that. Yeah. I'm not sure. Right.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Maybe that could also maybe help them get some kind of grants or whatever to help with a move. I don't know how you move all those books. I mean, that's a.
Yeah.
The library did it.
Right. Yeah, hand over hand, right?
I don't know. I love bookstores that sell used books and different things. Like, you know, it's always actually been my personal dream to have a cafe bookstore before there were Borders Books and Music Cafe and all that stuff. There was a little place in Park Slope where I lived for a while that was that kind of a place. And that was my favorite place to be, you know. So I worked at a bookstore once. Maybe that's my next job, you know, if I live another 20 years.
Yeah, go from one obsolete
to another. Yeah, why not? Another. I mean, or at least people don't hate booksellers, right?
It's impossible to hate books.
I don't know. Yeah. In some parts of the country, they're not real happy about the books taken out of the library. So just keep that in mind.
We should be taking all their anger out on the libraries. So
yeah. Well,
much easier to own a bookstore than to be a librarian, for sure.
Kinda.
Well, less education.
I'm still stuck on the congressional district map. I'm looking.
So where is Amityville?
Where is Amityville?
Well, Amityville is very much on the South Shore, and where Mr. Lalota lives, I won't say his address on the air, but
you know
it's public record. But like where he lives is like, you know, a little, it's on the water of, you know, what is this, Great South Bay?
But it is in our district or not? That's the question.
Oh, it's not. And it's not like, you know, the way district boundaries are drawn, let's talk about that. Like there's a portion of Calverton, which is in the town of Brookhaven, but it's still Calverton, right by the end of the expressway there. And that's in the second congressional district. I mean, which goes like on this, you know.
Is it all woods?
Up to like Riverhead's downtown. Like,
Give Nicolota another year and we'll get the boundaries changed to include his house in Amityville.
Well, that's probably it. But is it the 2024 plan? I don't know. But this is the current, you know.
It might be.
I don't think it's a priority because obviously it's not an issue for him.
Doesn't matter.
Right.
Well, the boundaries were redrawn right before Lee Zeldin took office. And
they were.
So, I mean, they've always been like election boundaries and district boundaries are always pretty weird. I mean, look at the County Ledge boundary that, like, you know, dipped down to take in Ed Romaine's neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. I want to see a weird one. Look at Jim Jordan's district in Ohio. It's like a snake. It just wraps to get all of the voters. Otherwise, he probably wouldn't be where he is.
So,
well, and the state has tried to reform, you know, all that, but it hasn't worked out really well the last few years. Anyway. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on WLIW-FM. I'm Bill Sutton from the Express News Group. My co-host Annette Hinkle from the Express News Group. Our panelists today, Denise Civiletti from Riverhead Local, Beth Young from the East End Beacon, and Christopher Gangemi from the East Hampton Star. Denise, there was another big proposal for Calverton, which seems to be the spot for new proposals. They want to build, what was it, 40, a new RV park up in Calverton dig a man-made lake, right?
Yeah, that's a popular thing to do. It's for good reason. So this is acreage inside the Enterprise Park that the town of Riverhead currently owns and which is currently the subject of, you know, a $40 million contract land deal that went bad and is now in litigation. This was presented to the town board at its work session yesterday by a Wading River resident who, I don't know that he hasn't ever done anything like this before. He's familiar around town hall because he's been trying to get approval to build this food waste to energy plant. Which is an anaerobic digester. That hasn't gone too well because I don't, for a variety of reasons, but he's still at it. And he told me yesterday he hasn't given up on that. Meanwhile, he's pitching this, and he would be the entity, or his company would be the entity that would excavate this 100 acre lake and 165 acre property that would be leased to him. And then he would
from the town.
By the town, yeah.
Right.
There are a couple of reasons why that's important, but being reminded that wonky stuff doesn't really, play. I won't go into it. But he would excavate this lake, create the lake, sell the sand that he's going to get out of there, which is, I don't know if that's his main motivation or not, but, it's very, very, it's a very, very lucrative business. And there's a big market for sand. As Supervisor Tim Hubbard said yesterday, sand is like gold. And then he would fringe this lake with these RV sites and some glamping cabins.
Ooh.
With like camping for glamorous camping. They call it glamping. I don't know.
Yeah, it's very popular.
Okay. So you can get TV, air conditioning, what's the point of camp? Anyway.
You can stay home.
Yeah. I don't know. So this is the proposal that's before the town board. It's not really formally filed yet as far as we know, but apparently it's been in discussion, and they rolled it out before the public yesterday at the work session. And he would contract with a nationally recognized or nationally, I don't know, firm, excuse me, that actually develops campgrounds and operates them. So he would just be sort of the Sandman. I don't know. There it was. I don't know. We'll see what happens. But the town board sounded pretty much like they loved the whole idea. Tim Hubbard said, as an RVer, he says it's
called it a home run, right?
Yeah, a home run, a win-win. You can't get RV sites in, unless you do it on the 1st of January every year. So I don't know.
I'm sorry, Bob. Go ahead.
It's the solution to all the hotels on the North Fork. If you're coming to a wedding on the North Fork,
yeah,
go RVing.
Go camping.
Is he planning any events or anything? Active runway. I mean, I don't. You know what I mean? Like, that kind of boggles my mind a little bit. Like, why would you want to go camping next to a runway? It's a wooded area, so maybe you wouldn't see the runway. But it's like, if it's being used for anything in the future, maybe it could get a little noisy there. Like, not exactly where I'd like to go camping, but
can we change the name from Calverton to Calhampton? Maybe that would attract.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But there have been various and sundry over the years proposals by people who want to come and dig a big hole for something.
Right.
And then, and then one of those succeeded. And today it's Scott's Point, formerly Island Water Park. The interesting thing is you can't discount a couple of things. One is there are a lot of environmental issues in that site. It's an environmentally sensitive area. There's a lot of groundwater contamination right near where they're talking about, building this thing. So that, I think, is going to be some kind of an issue that's got to be dealt with in a responsible way. And also, it's just so happens, I did like a little overlay for my own reference because, that wonk thing. But this site is this little wedge, which is east of the 10,000 foot runway, the eastern runway, is exactly where 555 Cat's phase one development would be. And I can't help but wonder if that has something to do with this proposal. Because there is this lawsuit. So I don't know. But
for the listeners, that was the proposed what were we calling it, a hub?
Well, I mean, logistics hub.
I'm sorry.
Air cargo logistics hub. We're going to bring in, you know, freight and et cetera. And
which the town rejected ultimately. And now it's all tied up in a lawsuit.
Right. The town rejected it after signing on to an application with the developer to the IDA for benefits. And then they said after the community went sort of, you know, crazy about it. And then they pulled back and now, you know, there's this lawsuit that has some pretty interesting allegations in it. But like, I can't help but wonder if that's really just a coincidence. That's exactly the same area where Cavalton Aviation and Technology said they were going to build their first buildings, their first logistics buildings. I mean, like, it totally conforms to that.
What would happen if the town gives this guy a green light and then all of a sudden Cat wins that loss?
So, you know, here's the thing. I mean, they're put on notice by this thing called a notice of pendency. That's a legal, you know, notice that gets filed with the county clerk. That's kind of like what they call a cloud on the title that puts people on notice that there's an action pending that could affect the title to this land. And a court could, if this notice of pendency stands, and, you know, if the Cavalton Aviation wins this lawsuit, a court could rule that this lease is void. But, you know, and I don't really know whether this could happen, but not until after
he sold all the sand.
Well, that leads me to the next thought, which is I wonder if, like, to avoid the significant depletion of an asset that they claim to, if the buyers couldn't get some kind of an injunction to prevent this from happening, because they're buying, you know, like, this would significantly affect the value of potentially of what they're buying. I don't know. I'm just, you know, my mind just goes crazy with all these silly thoughts, but it's kind of interesting to me. And we're going to see what, like, by the end of next week, the town is supposed to file its answer or some other response to the summons and complaint that it received in January. I don't know. So the plot thickens. I guess I could just leave it at that.
So as far as this RV park, I mean, it's just conceptual at this point. There's no application. Do we know if there's a next step?
Well, I mean, you know, filing an application or entering into a lease agreement. There would have to be a qualified and eligible hearing on it. And, you know, the town was talking like they're going to collect the, you know, the town charges, all these towns charge a, like, per cubic yard fee for exportation of materials. So, like, if you're building a commercially anyway, if you're building a store and you dig a basement and you're going to have to get rid of the materials, you have to pay the town so much. And I don't remember what the fee is, but so much per cubic yard. So they're talking about collecting that. But I'm thinking, shouldn't the town be getting something besides its regular fee, but like something for the value of the asset that it owns right now for that? Shouldn't maybe be just the fee? Like, right. I don't know.
The fee would be normally on land that you would own.
That you don't own. I mean, like, you know what I mean? Like, the town charges that fee if, Beth, if you own this property and you're going to build a, you know, and you're exporting it too, they're going to charge you this fee. Shouldn't they be getting more of a cut on if the they property own, that
yeah,
they own?
Absolutely. Yeah.
That should be built into the lease, I think. But who knows? I mean, I don't know. Their attorney is also, the guy's attorney is also the counsel to the Suffolk County Republican Committee. And
he's a activist. former legislator too, right?
I don't believe so. That's his brother, Dan.
Oh.
He's now the highway superintendent in Brookhaven. This is Stephen Lesquadro. And I don't know. I mean, he has a lot of different clients and he represents people in all different towns. And, you know, he's an attorney and that's, you know, but he's also the Republican Party attorney, and he's acted as parliamentarian at the Riverhead Republican nominating committee, you know, nominating conventions or whatever, the town, when they get together and decide who to nominate, because there have been some squabbles at those conventions. So he's been called in to, like, you know, he's kind of a big wig in the Republican Party and our all Republican town board, who's like, hey, this is a great idea. So I don't know.
Well, but that's how that works, right?
It is. Or how it doesn't really work very well for the rest of us sometimes. I don't know. I can't say that, well, if the Democrats were in charge, they would be doing the same thing, because they've never really been in charge of all the entire town board in that way. But I don't know. I don't know. It's kind of a weird proposal. And it's kind of strange that they'd be entertaining this while this whole thing is pending. And further, that this particular site is exactly where 555 Cat wants to develop phase one of its project. I just, yeah, like something that my gut tells me there's something more to that. But
well, we will keep checking out Riverhead Local for
and my updates, gut keeps expanding, so that must be doing something right.
All right, so Chris, back to Sag Harbor. You guys wrote about it, and we did too. The village finally reached a settlement with, I guess, now former police chief Austin AJ McGuire. After and the so there's a settlement that will allow him to retire, and with that settlement, the disciplinary charges that had been filed against him will be dismissed, right?
That's correct. After a few months of, it seemed to really start moving after November, when Mr. McGuire, I guess, was a notice of claim to the village, where it seemed like he wanted his job back.
Right.
And it was like, why aren't I getting my job back? Because at a meeting in August, I guess Tom let him know that the board was looking for
Tom Gardella,
right, for him to retire. And but no reason was really given to him at the time. So McGuire files this claim against the village, and then 2 weeks later, the board releases all of those charges.
Right.
And after a few months of negotiation, I guess they've come to this deal.
Just on a little bit of the background, I guess this all kind of came to a head last summer, and it the chief had made some claims about the former mayor and some issues with that, and then that had kind of made some headlines. And then when Mayor Gardella came into office, I guess reportedly a number of people from the police department approached him the day he was sworn in or the day after, with some concerns about Chief McGuire, who was then at some point he was. So in December, I guess the board suspended him, and some of the charges and the accusations had to do with his alleged drinking and drinking on the job and being intoxicated. And he did end up going to a rehabilitation facility and completed that, as far as we know. And then it just became a matter of the village had suspended him. That suspension ran out, and he's been kind of being paid since then, while they negotiated his future. I mean, right. is that all correct?
Yes,
as far as you know.
Yeah, right. And he did get. You know, he didn't. He was working without a contract since May of 2021, and that was a real source of tension.
Right.
And part of this settlement, he gets retroactive wage increases, and like you mentioned, he really has been paid since last July, when he first took sick leave, and then he was later put on administrative leave in September. But during that entire time, except for the month where he was suspended without pay, he was paid it at his retroactively increased wage level of $269,000 a year. And so, He leaves with a good settlement, especially from journalists' points of view, you know,
right.
We're like, oh yeah, that sounds pretty good. $269,000 a year. And yeah. I mean, God, 30%, of the village pays 30% into his pension, you know, for those years as well. It's, you know,
and he continued to the medical insurance and all that. The one thing I found just personally odd about the settlement, and maybe it's not, is that the part of the settlement was that the mayor would write him a letter of recommendation, and I guess that goes to, you know, to the good job he did, you know, prior to some of the issues that came up. It just seemed a little weird to me, but
yeah, I mean, they called it the standard good guy letter in the settlement. And, you know, like I mentioned in my article, AJ had been on the East Hampton Town Police for nearly 20 years before this. And when he was in the village all the time, you know, he'd see him jogging and, you know, he was always at school events and he was very approachable, you know, really good guy. And so it's, you know, I think that him and Mayor Gardella had a good personal working relationship, which is what the mayor told me. And so I think that this was kind of a hard situation for everybody to grapple with. And I think it's good that it's that they can move on now.
That's settled. And the acting chief, they're going to make him officially the acting chief and look at making him a permanent chief.
Right. But like in East Hampton Village, you know, they have to pass this chief exam. It's a civil service chief. And I guess it's not easy. And so that's the next step. They're going to have to negotiate with him and work out a contract. And then he's got to pass the test before he can become the full chief. But you're right. They can name him acting chief.
Not easy.
I think they could hire him. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Beth. I talked over you.
Yeah, that test is not easy. It's also not offered that often. So
right.
You have to pass.
Right. Maybe once a year.
Yeah, something like that.
Well,
yeah.
Well, they may need to do a special test for the village, which they did in Southampton. They had hired a chief provisionally, and you can do a provisional hire contingent on them then, you know, getting a certain score on the test in the future. So we'll watch that and see.
I'm facing something similar up on the North Fork with the police chief in South Old Town who needs to step down by late June, and they need to find someone qualified to replace him who has passed the test. So there'll be news on that coming up.
Yeah, that civil service stuff. I don't get that sometimes, but that's a whole different.
It seems kind of like a funny position to have to pass a civil service test for. It feels like there's other skills that maybe are super important.
Well, that's the culture, I guess, of that job and that profession. Anyway, we wish AJ, you know, well in his future, and certainly you know, he and his family, like you said, Chris, he's worked very hard, you know, serving the community for a long time. So, you know, hopefully moving forward, you know, he can find further success. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, a weekly news talk show on hosted by the Express News Group. I'm Bill Sutton from the Express News Group. My co-host Annette Hinkle from the Express News Group. Panelists today, Beth Young from East End Beacon, Denise Civiletti from Riverhead Local, and Christopher Gangemi from the East Hampton Star. Chris, you wanted to talk about speed bumps, or is it speed humps? Oh. I watched a Village of East Hampton village board meeting, and they were all about the speed humps, but I've heard it both ways. They're talking about maybe putting some in there, and we know that other areas on the East End, particularly Sagaponack, went crazy with the speed bumps to try to help slow and control traffic, right?
Yeah, well, so what I learned is that a speed bump is like a short, sharp shock, kind of, and it has to be on a private road or in a parking lot. Speed humps are the kind, they're a little bit longer, you know, in duration and a little bit maybe shorter in height. And those are what you see in Sagaponack. Those are humps. And then there's speed tables, which are even longer in duration. You know, so there's all this stuff. Then in East Hampton, it came up because there's a group of residents on La Forest Lane who wanted to turn it into a one-way road. They said in the summer, there's too much traffic. People are speeding down there. There was an e-bike, rather grisly e-bike accident on it last summer. And so they were in front of the board petitioning to turn it into one way. And the board is doing a traffic study. But in the meantime, they decided to put in these bumps or humps, sorry. Mm. And it just kind of one board member, Sarah Amidon, said, literally, it's going to open up a can of worms, because if you put speed humps on this road, what's to prevent everybody from wanting speed humps and coming and telling us that they want speed humps? You know, the real issue, it kind of gets into traffic apps like Waze in the summer, where they're pushing people off 27,
right,
and onto these, you know, side residential roads where people are blasting down them, and nobody looks at stop signs anymore, apparently, at least in my neighborhood. There's not that there's no enforcement. East Hampton Village did have cops on this road and handing out summons, but they can't be on every street all the time. And that's where the speed humps are coming into popularity, as well as speed cameras they're discussing too.
Hmm.
Sounds everyone's going to come to the North Fork.
Yeah,
exactly. We're your speed home. Taking it back to his camp.
We're pushing traffic to you.
North Fork in October, you're not going anywhere anyway. So
that's why it's been an
issue, I think, all across the South Fork, and Southampton Village is trying to deal with the same issue, Chris, that, you know, that all these what were formerly, you know, just residential side roads have become main arteries as people try to bypass the stuck traffic. And in Sagaponack, like we said, I mean, they popped up seemingly on I don't know how many roads, but, you know, a bunch, almost every road in Sagaponack. You can't go more than 10 miles an hour through the village. And I think they like that. And these humps would then, they're intended to slow traffic, but the thought is that they might divert traffic too, right? I mean, if you've got people who are using these Jody's shortcuts to, you know, to go through these residential neighborhoods, that they might think twice and either get back on 27 or find some other means to get around.
Yeah. That's the idea, is that they might divert some traffic, but you know, if they're thinking they're going to divert them back onto 27 is already clogged.
Right.
I don't know. It just seems like there's maybe too many cars for our infrastructure.
Right.
And I'm not sure how you fix that problem unless you maybe put a toll on at Shinnecock. Something that a couple of people have, floated.
Former Southampton Supervisor Jay Schneiderman was all in favor of that. He liked that idea. Mm-hmm. You know, with the new technology, as far as using the cameras to, you know, like they do on the thruway now, you could have people who could have, you know, residents who wouldn't have to pay some of the tolls, but you could have, you know, you could do a congestion pricing, you could do, yep, contractors pay more, you could do all that.
I mean, if you think about the costs, it's going to cost East Hampton Village $18,000 for 3 speed bumps on this tiny road. Humps. Yep, the humps. And think about the cost to the municipalities from all of this traffic. Germain in Sag Harbor is completely clogged every morning during the school rush hour with contractors using that as a cut through to avoid 27. So there's costs to the municipalities for this traffic that they're not getting, you know, anything for. You know, Sag Harbor is putting paid parking now in behind, you know, the IGA. They're looking for income streams. I don't know. I think that something's got to give. And I think there needs to be something to kind of have less out here.
Yeah.
Because I don't think you can't speed bump every road. You can't divert everybody to 27. Ultimately, that's not a solution.
You need to make the train go back to Sag Harbor.
There you go.
Well, and for every speed hump you put on one road, like you said, Chris, that you're just pushing them to a different road, and you know, and then those people are going to want some kind of traffic calming measure, right, or whatever. And
which is why Chris Minority voted against the speed humps in East Hampton Village, which is pretty strange because that board rarely has dissent. So that, I think, is to your point, Bill.
Yeah. So we only have a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to mention the new arrival in Sag Harbor Village at Marine Park, a donated life-sized statue of John Steinbeck and his dog Charlie seems to be creeping some people out.
Nobody would really go on the record with their criticisms of the statue, but suffice it to say, a number of other institutions refused the statue for good reasons. And it ends up in Steinbeck Park, and it's very realistic looking, especially from a distance, like a wax. It's bronze. It's painted bronze, and it depicts John Steinbeck writing with his dog, but his head's kind of at this kind of weird angle. And if you're driving over the bridge into North Haven, you see it, the sunset behind it, and you see this silhouette of this guy and his dog all the time. It's like a presence there in the park, even if you don't look closely at it. And if you look closely at it, that's when it really gets kind of creepy, you know?
It's almost too realistic, right? I mean, and I guess that's what makes it a little odd. What did you think of it, Annette?
I haven't seen it. I honestly had no clue. Like everybody else in Sag Harbor, nobody knew this thing was going to pop up. It showed up over the weekend. I have yet to go to pay homage to Steinbeck and Charlie, but I do think the painted aspect is a little odd. I mean, if it was just a bronze, right, I could see it, isn't that an interesting, you know, homage, but to have it painted, it just gives it, yeah, that slightly surrealistic look.
Which if I think we had a quote from the artist, and that's exactly what he was looking for, was that realistic feel.
Yeah. I'm going to go visit him this weekend. I think,
we should all plan a field trip to go.
There aren't a lot of benches in that park.
Yeah. Well, one less now for people.
The bench is part of the sculpture, isn't it?
I don't know. The thing. I can't quite get a sense, since I haven't seen it in person, where it is. But it was, so the bench was not there for humans before this, right?
No, I believe that the bench is part of this sculpture.
Okay.
And, you know, to what you're saying, I mean, I was getting a coffee this morning in the village, and I heard two people talking about going to visit the statue. And Steinbeck Park, you could argue, is kind of underused. So if people are going suddenly now to visit this, you know, perhaps creepy-ish statue, you know, maybe it's just another strange little quirk there by the bridge in Sag Harbor. Frankly, I wish that there was a statue of Pedro, maybe reclining, because when I used to drive into the village, he was always there asleep on that same hill where this John Steinbeck statue is. And I think that there should have been some kind of homage to
food for thought there. We are out of time. We're actually over time. Everybody go visit the Steinbeck statue. I want to thank my co-host Annette Hinkle, from the Express News Group, Beth Young from East End Beacon, Denise Civiletti from Riverhead Local, and Christopher Gangemi from the East Hampton Star. Thank you, guys. Really good show today. Thanks.